I've been playing a new game.
Has it got roguelike elements?
You beat me to it.
It has no roguelike elements whatsoever.
Who are you and what have you done with Mark?
So the game I've been playing is Baldur's Gate 3.
Ah.
Which, as the name suggests, is a sequel to a game called Baldur's Gate, which is a Dungeons & Dragons computer RPG of yore. I think many would probably consider it the sort of quintessential Dungeons & Dragons game for computer. It spawned a sort of, I suppose, loosely connected universe of similar games in the sort of, I guess, was it the late 90s it first came out, early noughties, through to this day. And this is the latest, after quite a while, in the series.
Having never seen it before, is this a first-person perspective or isometric, or what does it look like?
Well, the original Baldur's Gate was sort of a fixed isometric view, a sort of party RPG. So you've got your characters running around a map, and yeah, it's following them a sort of isometric view. This is a bit more 3D. You're sort of viewing it from above, but you can also control the camera a bit, and it sort of follows you around behind your character as you go. So it's sort of third person over the shoulder kind of view, if you prefer it like that. And then some parts switch into more of a sort of fully 3D.
Cinematic.
Yes, exactly, kind of view.
Does it require significant compute resources to play?
Well, to answer that question, I'll tell you, I'm playing it on my Steam Deck.
Ah, okay.
Perfect. Modest, then.
Yes, so this is the first sort of AAA new release game that I've played on my Steam Deck. So I've played quite a few old, big games, and I've played some newer sort of indie games that, you know, you'd expect to have lower requirements. But this is the first one, which is a big release with big sort of graphical options that I've bought and played on the Steam Deck.
Okay, so if it's new and big, what are the storage requirements, and did that present any interesting hurdles?
It didn't at first, but I discovered this week that basically I can have one big game like this on the Steam Deck at a time.
Well, I could only load one cassette at a time on my Sinclair Spectrum, so, you know.
I've got the 256 gig model of the Steam Deck, and the game itself is, I think, somewhere in the region of 90 gig.
Wowzers.
Right.
Yes. So then when I tried to install another game to play, I realised that actually this is probably the time to buy an SD card. So, yes, now I can fit more than one game on at a time. But initially, I found the game played very well in handheld mode on the Steam Deck's own screen. But quite a lot of the time, I play with the Steam Deck plugged into my living room TV, which is a 42-inch 4K display. And that wasn't great.
Driving it at 4K?
No. So it's a 720p image. Well, 720p frames blown up to 4K on the telly.
Right.
And generally that's not too much of a problem, but there's quite a lot of detail in quite a lot of the scenes in Baldur's Gate 3. You're running around like environments with trees with individual leaves on, and there's quite a lot of hair effects. So when you've got a close-up of a character, you can see individual strands of hair, and that looked pretty bad initially. You could see sort of like the edges of all of this detail, and it wasn't rendered particularly well. But then they released a patch which added support for something called, ready for this, Fidelity FX Super Resolution 2.2.
I am familiar with this technology.
Wow.
This is an AMD technology. I think we might have spoken about NVIDIA's equivalent in the past as well. This is basically, rather than the GPU rendering higher quality frames, it renders lower quality frames and then uses machine learning to upscale them, because that's apparently an easier thing to do now.
Yeah. So I think the NVIDIA solution talks about machine learning, but the AMD solution uses like temporal frame analysis to do all of this stuff. So right. I don't think they make any sort of machine learning claims in their literature, but the effect is the same. Render at a lower resolution, which it can do quickly, and then upscale the result to try and give you better fidelity.
Yeah. So with this turned on, my world was changed, and suddenly it looks brilliant.
Oh.
All of these sort of artifacts around the edges of all of the detail are gone, and everything looks brilliant, which I'm still not sure quite why, because at the end of the day, I'm still displaying a 720p frame blown up onto a 4K telly. I don't know if it's just that with this in place, the TV can then do a better job of upscaling itself without it being so janky or whether something else is happening that I just don't understand. But anyway, I was really impressed with this.
So to be clear, you're saying it's not possible for the Steam Deck to render 4K directly to your telly via the USB port?
I think it might be possible, but the games don't let you set them higher than 720. So if I plug it, if I go into desktop mode,
right,
I can display the desktop in 4K. But if I'm in the game and I go into the graphics settings, the highest resolution option, the only resolution option I have is 720.
Is that because you're mirroring what's on the, is it showing both on the local display and on the TV at the same time?
No, only on the TV. The internal screen turns off when I plug it in, when I'm in gaming mode.
Interesting. I would have expected as soon as you plug an external display in for it to, you know, ramp the CPU and GPU up and the fan starts spinning more and you get more pixels.
I guess you're still limited by what the Steam Deck can do and it can't do a lot more than it can display on the internal screen.
Hmm.
Yeah, I had heard that Valve had a hand in helping ensure that that game worked on release day on the Steam Deck. So maybe there's some Steam Deck specific code path in there to say, don't offer a resolution that's, you know, not going to end well.
Right. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. But generally speaking, it's a lot of fun as a game. I mean, I'm a fan of other people playing Dungeons & Dragons. I've tried it a couple of times myself and, I suppose I've probably never had the right group of people to play it with, but I like listening to other people playing it. And playing this game gives me that kind of same experience of enjoying the story and little sort of episodic chunks of it as you explore around. It's quite a dense game. You can move around and, you know, you just go, oh, I'll just go that way. And then you discover something interesting, which will give you a little bit for an hour. And then you can just sort of save and go and do something else and come back the next day and have another little adventure. And it's managed to integrate the kind of dice rolling mechanic of Dungeons and Dragons quite well into the game itself without it being too much of a chore. It lets you solve problems in your own way, but you have to have a character with enough skill and enough luck, let's say, to achieve what you're trying to do. So each option has a difficulty and then you have to perform a dice roll to beat that difficulty, but your character may have traits which make it a bit easier for them, or you might have come across something that lets you have a bonus on that roll or something like that, which is quite nice. I like the way they've integrated that.
Is it linear or quite open world?
It's somewhere in between. I mean, there's a linear story, but there's a few paths that you can take and you could either just follow straight through that story or you can meander off and find side quests and things like that.
Nice. How much was it?
Somewhere in the region of 50 quid, I think.
Right.
And using my metric of if I play for more than an hour per pound I spend, it's a good game. I'm well on my way already to this being a very good game.
Excellent.
I hear by many people's account that this is sort of a contender for game of 2023, all things considered.
I would certainly say so. It's my game of 2023.
Okay, that's an endorsement right there.
I've been going loco in Ubuntu.
Oh, not Acapulco.
No, wrong. Not Acapulco, no. So there's been an initiative in the community team at Canonical to reboot the Loco project. And for those who don't know, Loco, L-O-C-O, is shorthand for local communities. It's not for, you know, Loco, the Southern American way of saying it. It's groups of people getting together, advocating for, supporting other people, contributing to. It's like Linux user groups, but for Ubuntu specifically. And they're generally geographically confined to a state or country or city or island or whatever. And also they have in the past been the main way that translations were done, because generally speaking, geographically, people speak specific languages in certain places and Ubuntu needed translating for those particular places. So that's what it was historically. And over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, the membership of Loco teams has kind of tailed off and there's been a lack of incentive, a lack of motivation to get people contributing to Locos. And if you go and have a look at some of the mailing lists, yes, they still use mailing lists. A lot of them are a bit dead. or, you know, inactive as people have moved on to other stuff like Discord and Discourse and Matrix and Mattermost and all these other different ways of communicating. And I think Canonical wanted to give this whole thing a bit of a reboot. And I heard about this a little bit while I was at the Ubuntu Summit a little while ago. And it got me thinking, we have a loco in the UK. And it was kind of out of the loco that the old Ubuntu podcast was born. Like, there's a whole bunch of us who were in the loco or knew each other from the LUG, and there was a lot of overlap there, and it started. And the UK loco has kind of languished a bit for quite a while. So I thought I'd give it a kick up the backside. And some other people in the community have been wanting to give it a kick up the backside. And there's a few resources that the loco has that have gathered dust and got cobwebs on them. And I thought I'd try and dust them off and help sort them out. One of them was the Launchpad team. There's a Launchpad team called Ubuntu -UK. And that was owned by Alan Bell, who was the last voted in leader of the loco years ago. Now, he doesn't even live in the UK anymore. He lives in Ireland. He Brexited his way out of the country and has had other things to focus on. And so I pinged him an email the other day and said, "Oi, hand it over." And he did. And so I am now the interim stand-in leader for the Ubuntu UK loco, but just to the point where I can get this stuff bootstrapped, and then I'm happy to hand it over to somebody else to look after. I don't necessarily want to be leader. I just want to help get the thing moving again. And the other thing that was quite interesting was the website. The UbuntuUK.org website has been hosted for years on a Bitfolk VPS that we have slightly mismanaged over the years by not upgrading it through many releases. It's currently sat on 18.04. I think it might even be a 32-bit VPS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, isn't it because we can't upgrade it any further?
Yeah. And, you know, we could reprovision, but it's just time and effort migrating because the old podcast files are still on there as well. And so, you know, nobody's really had the time or motivation to do it. It's kind of frozen in Aspic, the server. And we had to shut down the WordPress install because it was getting out of date and crusty and was getting spam. So I thought, right, let's take the bull by the horns and fix this. So I had a chat with Martin, and he's all about GitHub Actions. So given that I've played with Hugo a little bit, I thought, I know, I'll just spin up a static site using Hugo and deploy it with GitHub Actions to the free hosting on GitHub, because that's an easy way for people to contribute. Anyone can drive by, fix a typo or add a post or something, because Hugo is relatively straightforward to use, and just let the automation inside GitHub publish the site once pages have been reviewed.
You're still quite new to using GitHub Actions. So how did you find all of that process?
It was interesting that I could just copy and paste somebody else's example. If you do a search for, you know, GitHub Actions deploy and stuff, you find it on the Hugo website. The Hugo website is gohugo.io. And there's a page there all about how to deploy using GitHub Actions, and literally copy and paste the example in, and it immediately worked. It's just, I had a website straight away. It was minutes to get started. It was more difficult futzing around with the Hugo theme and trying to, I spent more time looking for a theme than I did like figuring out how GitHub Actions work.
Yeah, my experience with Hugo and GitHub Actions is similar in that I never could quite get my head around how that whole Jekyll process was supposed to work when you use Jekyll to publish to GitHub pages. But the Hugo integration is just mega simple. It was just literally, as you say, copy the example and it just worked.
So I had a basic, literally, it was hello world, you know. It just said Ubuntu UK and there was not a lot more. And I mentioned this on the Ubuntu Discourse where we were having a conversation about rebooting the UK loco. And they've created categories for each of the locos who want to have conversations about rebooting. And so in the Ubuntu UK category, I was chatting about the website reboot. And someone from Ubuntu Korean loco team said, "Oh, well, we've got a website. It's open source. You can copy that if you want. And it's got all the official, in inverted commas, Ubuntu branding all over it, and uses the vanilla framework that all the Canonical websites use." And I thought, well, yes. So I threw away the work that I'd done on the existing website, and the Ubuntu Korea team's website is Hugo as well. So everyone wins. And they also deploy using GitHub Actions. So this was another copy and paste, and then all I had to do was...
translate everything from Korean.
Yes, delete all the Korean. Well, there was a lot in English already, and so I just stripped out some of the Korean stuff and pointed the links to the right places and hit publish, and there's now a not completely finished Ubuntu UK website hosted on GitHub. And what I would really like to do is for other people in the UK who want to get involved to come along and help do this. I've created an organization on GitHub called Ubuntu-UK, and there's a repo in there, and that's where the website is, and it's very easy to get going. I've put instructions in the README that tell you how to use Hugo and how to test it locally and all that kind of stuff. It's pretty straightforward. But yeah, join us on Discourse and help us with the website, please.
So that's all very interesting. So there's a nice shiny new website now. I think I've been a member of the Ubuntu UK Launchpad group for, I don't know, over a decade, but I don't know what that means. So now there is a website. What sort of things could people promote and get involved in and nurture for the UK loco?
You are one of 1,000 plus people who are members of that Ubuntu UK loco team on Launchpad. And it's all the usual stuff. Like, it could go from organizing translations or having a bug drive or doing testing before a release. All the usual stuff that we talk about. All of this is detailed on the Ubuntu Wiki, ways to get involved. But really, I just want to see who's interested in keeping this going and maintaining it. I wanted to use GitHub Actions and make the website nice and easy so that it wasn't an onerous overhead for people to sign up for. But all the other stuff is just, you know, do what you normally do, you know, file bugs, triage bugs, get involved in whatever way is appropriate. If someone out there could do us an Ubuntu UK loco logo that fits the style that the Ubuntu logo is, a kind of vertical with the logo at the bottom of the vertical rectangle. If you go to the link that will be in the show notes, you'll probably see it. Maybe by the time you hear this, someone who will have contributed a logo. I don't know. But I would love for people to jump on Discourse as well and join in the conversation and see what we can organize, whether it's in-person events or virtual or just, you know, testing and contributing in the way that we've been contributing to Ubuntu for, like, what, nearly 20 years now? I think it's an easy way to have a hobby, really.
I am here to regale you with stories of yet more impure abominations from the world of NixOS.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, a couple of months ago, I think I was telling you about how I was running Flatpak or Flatpaks on NixOS, and today I'm running Snaps on NixOS 2.
Are they not going to cast you out of this NixOS community with your weird perversions of package managers on top of NixOS? Surely they want everyone to just use Nix the way it was intended.
Yes, there's definitely an army of people that would subscribe to that. And certainly there is a lot of benefit to doing that. And by and large, I do subscribe to using Nix to fully create a pure environment. But you know what? There's just sometimes interesting software out there that you want to get, and it's maybe not in Nix packages. And so enter Flatpak, AppImage, and now Snap as a way to supplement your available software library.
Do I understand correctly that you could already build Snaps on NixOS, but you couldn't run them?
Yeah, so thanks to John Seeger, who a few months ago published a flake called Crafts Flake, that gave me the ability to access Snapcraft, which is the tool for building snaps. And so you can run that natively on NixOS. It then talks to LexD as the clean environment in which the snap builds take place. So that meant that I could build the snaps I'm responsible for maintaining without having to get into creating virtual machines and what have you. So that was a little productivity boon for me. But once I'd built a snap, of course, now I have to actually create that virtual machine I was just referring to in order to install said snap and make sure it actually works properly. So now, thanks to the efforts of, I think it's Benjamin Levy, they have published a flake of Nick's SnapD, which is SnapD and therefore the fabric of being able to install and run snaps on Nick's OS.
As I understand it from your repeated explanations of how Nick's OS works to me over coffee in the office, and it's not sinking in, I'm sorry. You have this whole system where you can like go to a directory and all the right software is available to you in that folder for that activity that you want to do, whether it's software development or playing a game or whatever, right?
Right.
If you install this SnapD flake, does that mean SnapD is only available in certain circumstances, or is it available at all times anywhere?
Okay, so that's a good question. There is a couple of ways that you can use Nix. And what you were describing initially there, where you said you can go to a directory and software is magically temporarily available, that's using Nix shells, where if you have a development project you're working on, I have something that I'm working on in Rust at the moment, it can declare all of the software I need to build and run that application. And when I'm in that directory working on that project, that software is available to me. And as soon as I wander off elsewhere on the system, it magically vanishes from my system. However, you can also have full system installed software, which is available at all times. And obviously SnapD fits into that category because it runs as a daemon, because the daemon is there to sort of broker and mediate all of the activities that happen when you install and execute snaps. So in this case, SnapD is a system-wide, always available capability.
Got it.
And which snaps, now that you have this, did you want that you can't get via other means on Nix?
Oh, my giraffe emoji.
So, as it happens, this snap arrived at exactly the right time because I upgraded early to Nix OS 23.11. So the version numbers of Nix OS are just like Ubuntu. It's year.month and they're 1 month offset from Ubuntu releases. And I upgraded, I think, 3 weeks before the actual release. And one of the bits of software that I use daily is Gitkraken. And in that in-development version of Nix OS, that version of Gitkraken is broken. And it doesn't work properly. And so I had a sad face. Now, the day that I did this, this flake of SnapD was published. And Axsoft, the vendor for Gitkraken, publish a snap. So I install SnapD on Nix OS and then I snap install Gitkraken and I get the current version of Gitkraken and all my woes are solved because it's all working for me.
Can I ask an awkward question?
You can.
Which I think I'm going to channel from the Nix OS people who are listening to this. Why didn't you spend the time fixing the flake or fixing the Nix native package rather than go off-piste and install this SnapD abomination? That was your words. You said that, not me.
So I have done what you've suggested. I have worked on a PR to fix Gitkraken, but that has to go through a whole approval process. And in the meantime, I've still got a broken Gitkraken. So I did fix it and I had what's called an overlay. But you know what? I've got choices now. I can just install the snap and get it authoritatively from the vendor. So why not do that? It's just another way to solve the problem. I tried the Flatpak as well, which also worked, but the theming was busted because that's a thing still apparently. So that's why I used the snap as my interim solution.
And if the theming is busted with Flatpaks, does everything work okay with snaps? Or have you come across any other rough edges?
No, it works perfectly fine. As it happens, Gitkraken is a classic snap. So really, it's just running as an isolated application like every other Nix OS application.
Interesting. So do you think you're just going to use this as an emergency escape hatch for when Nix OS packages break, which I'm sure that doesn't happen very often, and this was an edge case.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you think you're going to use this ongoing for maybe other applications that are more readily up to date or available as Snap App Image or Flatpaks?
I don't know. I think I'll use it in my tool belt in case I need something that's only available as a snap. There is one big caveat to this current implementation in that there is no confinement. So if you're used to running snaps on most other platforms, you get full confinement, and that's currently disabled. I did see just prior to recording this episode of the podcast, the creator of this Nix implementation of SnapD has some patches now which compile with AppArmor enabled, and I've done a little reading to see that there are capabilities within NixOS to enable AppArmor at a system level as well. So it may be possible that they can be fully confined at some point in the future. But for now, it's just another great way for me to get software that isn't available anywhere else. For example, Defold.
Oh, tell me more about Defold, Martin.
Well, I have a friend of mine who was listening very keenly when I said I like the Defold game engine. It's fantastic. And they conveniently made a snap of it, which you can find at snapcraft.io/Defold. And I am here to tell you it works brilliantly on NixOS as a snap.
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah, I made that. So,
thank you.
Yeah, neat.